Shine.fm presents Stronger Together, a show about growing in marriage, parenting, relationships, and community. Here's Seth Tower Hurd.
This is Stronger Together. My name is Seth Tower Hurd. Dan and Angie Leverance are both vocalists, worship leaders, people with a lot of church experience, and parents. And it's how you got to that last title that we're really going to dive into on Stronger Together, because this is one of those things that I think, as you've found out, Angie, since you wrote a book about it, that, you know, is so common, and a lot of times the church has no idea what to do with it. Like, oh, this isn't one of those topics in life that has, you know, that really good little like sermon zinger on the end. So a lot of times we just don't talk. And so that's what we're going to do on this particular episode. The book is called A Tale of Mending. And you wrote this basically to remember, you know, to have this down, right? And then all of a sudden people asked you to like start like traveling and speaking. And all of a sudden it became not just your story, but it became something that other people grabbed onto. Okay, so walk me through kind of how this happened, you know, and basically the life events that led up to being an author about loss.
Sure. Dan and I got married back in the 1900s. Yeah. 98, and we were young and in love and just wanted to kind of enjoy those years together for a while, and we waited to start trying for a family. And then around 2001, we had just recently moved from California back to Michigan, and we thought, hey, this is a perfect opportunity to start trying because we're near our family again. And so we did, and just like most people, we thought this was going to go great. You know, we had a perfect plan for our lives and wanted to dive right in. We got pregnant, boom. It was great. Like, things were going really well in the first trimester. And then we had spent a really awesome day with Dan's family in at Lake Michigan, and came home to discover that I was miscarrying for the first time. And I remember just being in complete and utter shock and had no kind of understanding of what to even do. Just great sadness. And it happened so quickly that I just kind of like, okay, what's going on, you know? And then went to see the doctor. You know, they explained that it happens so often.
It was the first time that we had heard how common miscarriage was, because it was just devastating for us at that point.
Right, because people don't really talk about it.
And if I can jump in there, what is the actual stat? Like, how many?
One in four pregnancies
end in miscarriage.
Mm-hmm. And so then we decided, you know, let's just kind of chill for a little bit. Let's get through another month and see what happens. And we just were really hopeful. So we started trying right again, and the next month, 2 months later, we were pregnant again. We had no trouble
only ever had trouble staying pregnant.
Yeah. And so that second one, basically I tested positive and got my period like 2-3 weeks later. So it was a really early in the first trimester of miscarriage. So my doctor started telling me these first two were most likely chromosomal abnormalities, which is just very common. I mean, he told me that it's like a miracle for us, you know, a little pile of cells to get to the end, you know, like God is in that, you know, and
it's a miracle every time.
It's a miracle every time. And there's so many things that have to go right. And when one thing doesn't, it just, your body knows how to move on. And so that was really, really difficult to hear. And pretty much anything that the only thing that I had wanted to do in life, really, with my time every day, was be a mom. I really had no career aspirations. I mean, I had had jobs that were really great, but I wanted to be a mom. And so that's when I really started questioning and asking God, you know, if this is the desire you've placed in my heart, you know, who am I? What do I do? You know, if this isn't going to work. And so we took a little breather then, and kind of dove into work.
Yeah, and then we moved again. So we moved from Michigan to Minnesota, and we just had a lot of stuff going on in life. So we just gave ourselves some time to heal. And then when we got to Minnesota, decided we were going to try again. We had a new set of doctors, and yeah, we had no idea.
And I had had tests by then, and really everything was working okay. I didn't have anything clearly saying, you know, your body doesn't work right. You can't have kids. No, it was fine. And so
and at the same time, doctors telling us that they had worked with women who've experienced 8, 9, 10 miscarriages before delivering a healthy baby. And so, you know, our minds are
I'm not even sure I can get my head around
No, we couldn't either.
It happens. There are people that just keep on trying, and I just, Lord bless them, because their hope is, like, strong. And so, anyway, we decided to try again, and boom, right away again, got pregnant, and this time felt different. Like, I don't know how to articulate it other than I just sailed through the first trimester. I started feeling little flutterings. Like, I was like, I'm really pregnant. This is going to happen, you know, and I was really tempted to just be absolutely joyful, but when you've gone through loss like that, pregnancy changes, and it really becomes, you become a little bit cynical and like, when is the shoe going to drop? And so I was really trying hard. I was praying a lot. Lord, help me enjoy this pregnancy. Excuse me. And so in April of 2004, this was really the most traumatic experience that we shared. I just went into labor at 18 weeks. And I remember waking up and thinking, I cannot believe this is actually happening. Like, what are you doing, God?
Yeah, at that point, we were beyond first trimester, which, you know, statistically, risk of miscarriage goes way down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we were, at that point, we had let our hopes get up again.
Yeah, huge. So we didn't end up with the greatest ER doc in the world. And he just was kind of shaking his head. Your baby has a strong heartbeat. We don't know what's really happening other than your body's going into labor. We don't know how long this is going to take. There's really very slim chance that you will stop. There's nothing they can do, you know, as far there's like a week in there where they can start helping you and give the baby steroids, that kind of thing, but I was too early. And so he sent us home, and I ended up delivering our sweet little girl in the bathroom at our apartment. And that, as you can imagine, was the most traumatic experience I've had in a while, ever. Dan, you know, a lot of times people have irrational thoughts at this time. He left at that time to go get us some groceries. Do you remember that?
Before it had actually
happened. Yeah, because we had nothing in the house.
The doctor had sent us home, and here I am as the husband just wanting my wife to be comfortable, and she had some kind of craving, and I was like, well, I'll go to the store and get groceries. Yeah. I'll go get it for you. And,
and as, just wanted to help.
And as I'm away, she's, you know, having this experience, and I come home to her in the bathroom.
Yeah.
It was very, very traumatic for her and for both of us.
We whisked ourselves back to the hospital, and that, really, that whole event started to be kind of the death of a dream for a biological parenthood. Like, we just were devastated, and I slipped into some pretty significant depression at that time. I sought counseling, started taking some antidepressant medication, and that is when God started helping me embrace the story that I was on. Because in the counseling sessions, it was so weird, because I bought a book in college that I never read. And I love allegory, and so I was like, I'm going to read this book at some point, but I just never did. So I was busy with college work. So my counselor mentioned it, and I was like, oh, I have that book. And it's Hinds Feet on High Places by Hannah Hernard. It's a really old school 70s book. But it talks about a character named Much Afraid journeying through her life with the great shepherd, the gentle shepherd, and all the things that she faces. And one of the biggest things is craven fear, which, you know, in allegory was referring to the enemy. And it just spoke straight to my heart. Every part of it helped me understand who I am in the Lord and who I am on this journey that I'm on, and that grief could be my friend, that I could embrace the pain and let it be the place where I'm really real and raw with God.
That I've never heard before. Let's camp out there for just a minute. So grief being your friend.
Yeah. People laugh when I say that, because they're like, grief is the enemy, you know, like that's the painful place. But God just flipped it for me in my head. There's scriptures and Lamentations that talk about both good things and calamity comes from the Lord, the mouth of the Most High. And it started clicking with me that, you know, everything comes to us sifted through the hands of our Heavenly Father, and even the hard things can sift through, because he knows where he wants us to be in our story. and he's writing it. I'm not in charge. I'm not a pawn in this world. He's in charge. And so when he showed me that grief could really be a place where I can identify with what Jesus went through, you know, that's when I was like, okay, I don't have to be afraid of this. It doesn't have to be evil and horrible, and I can embrace it and let her become my friend. And she became a character in my story.
Before we move on, I want to backtrack a little bit here. So you guys, you know, were past the first trimester, so people probably knew. Uh-huh. I just want to talk about how, as a Christian, talk about tough things to people, which I feel like a lot of times is just acknowledge it, live with them, and shut up.
Like, yeah.
You know, I lost a brother in childhood, and I think back to some of the things that people said, like, that were well-intentioned, and I'm like, why did you think that was a good idea? Where did you get this at? Just shut up. Like, literally, just don't even do anything. Avoid me.
There's characters.
It's actually better than being this weird, right?
Mm-hmm. Or saying, we had people telling us if we would just use their chiropractor, this wouldn't have happened. And I mean, unbelievably ridiculous things that I really think people are well-intentioned.
Yeah. I name them in my book. Yes. Mr. and Mrs. Means Well. So,
yeah.
Because they do. They mean well. And so it's almost like I got to a point where I had to make other people feel better about what had happened to me.
Yeah.
Because how they were dealing with it at church and stuff. So that was really difficult.
Well, can you say that again? You had to make other people feel better.
I had to make them feel better about what I was going through, because they were like projecting all these things onto me and giving me all this great advice. And I'd be like, you know, it's okay. You know, God's writing my story. I'll figure this out. You know, thanks for your input. But, you know, and then just kind of move on.
You know, as I think about having gone through the line at Wake's visitations, and what I've always said is, I am blah, blah, blah. I knew this person, you know, because of whatever. I'm so sorry for your loss. Because anything else just probably doesn't need to be said.
Yeah. Like,
the people who were the most meaningful to us were the people who just were with us and who did exactly that.
Over.
We had a graveside service for Zoe, and we still have really precious memories of that, and people just being with us.
And taking care of us.
Mm-hmm. That's what we needed. We didn't need advice at that point, and we didn't need whatever you think your solution to our problem is. We were grieving.
Love and comfort.
Yeah, we just needed comfort and encouragement and love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just acknowledgement, like you said, that it's real. Like, this person is real. Mm-hmm. You know, she didn't get to be born at the time when baby was supposed to be born, but she was a real human being. Excuse me.
Going back to, you know, when you knew that you needed some help, you know, moving on, what was the sign to you that you needed to step into counseling? And, you know,
constant tears, constant. I mean, the feeling of lowness all the time. And I remember just, you know, Dan and then some irrational stuff too. Like, I had some mood swings. My hormones were out of whack because I had two, three miscarriages. And then I didn't tell you about the fourth. I mean, we ended up 2 years later experiencing a fourth miscarriage, but this was after some counseling, and that one again was chromosomal. So just your hormones are going crazy. You can tell when you just don't feel like yourself anymore, and that's where I was.
It's also helpful to have other people in your life helping you to realize that. It's one thing for Angie to live in the low, but she's kind of in the experience and feeling all the things that she's feeling, and not necessarily as objective as she would be if she were in a healthy spot. And so those were the times, and they're tricky to navigate, but those were the times where, you know, other people had to say to us, have you considered counseling?
Mm-hmm.
It might be why. And we had people that we trusted, and thankfully, by the grace of God, listened to, you know, and it was a great experience.
Yeah.
So at some point you realize this just isn't going to happen for you guys. You talked about the death of the dream, right? So, I mean, that's its own grieving process, letting something like that go.
And you know what? It's not really ever over. I mean, because there's stings that remind me, oh, yeah, you don't have biological children, you know, like that just come up in life. Go to baby showers or see child dedications at church. And there's just a little, I mean, I am completely fulfilled in being a parent to our son who came to us through adoption. But there's still just a grieving process that probably will go on. You know, it's just less intense than it used to be. So.
Yeah, and we, after that third loss, like we knew that we did not have the emotional stamina to keep enduring miscarriage after miscarriage after miscarriage until we delivered a healthy baby. At that point, God brought a pretty amazing family into our lives. Mm-hmm. And we kind of, I mean, I think we had always, everybody I think has some kind of awareness that this adoption thing exists, but we had people literally walk right into our lives and it was like God just put them there. And we fell in love with the idea of adoption. It was very scary, and yeah. I had a long way to come. Like yeah. Angie was on board far before I was.
So what was hard about that for you?
Oh, the fear of the unknown. You know, like I was grieving. Yeah.
The cost.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was grieving. I was grieving in my own way mm-hmm. too. But yeah, there's a lot that's scary. I had this. Kind of preconceived notion, like this home study would be the most unbelievable invasion of my privacy. And,
yeah.
you know, they were going to be like the Gestapo, you know, looking for any, you know, way to just like...
white gloves to check
yeah,
the
desk. Right? And, yeah. and it wasn't that way. But like, you just have all these preconceived notions yeah. about what that is. And until you actually take some steps of faith and actually talk to other people who've been through the experience and then start it yourself, it starts to get a little less scary. It's, you know, taking the first step on any journey, once you've actually taken a step, it gets a little easier.
Right. And this family that Dan's talking about, you know, they just exemplified how anybody can do it. I mean, you just have to take a step. And so, you know, just getting to know them showed me that we can do this too,
yep.
you know.
So after third miscarriage, the place that we came to was, we will try one more time. And if that pregnancy ends in miscarriage, then we will pursue adoption, because we also realize that there are so many kids in the world who just need families.
Yeah.
And our yeah. we felt like our dream and our calling wasn't, we never felt like God was saying you need to be a biological parent. We knew that we wanted to parent and we wanted to be a family.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started walking down the road toward adoption and
bit it off little by little. It's a long process.
Scary as it was, yeah.
And at that point, did you feel fairly healed?
No.
No.
Nope.
Somewhat. I will say that my eyes were opened in a whole new way to the suffering in the world. Because once you start thinking about the fact that there are orphans that have no parents and are living in abject poverty, I mean, then it's not to change or minimize what I had been through, but it gave me new eyes to see, wow, the brokenness now that I'm going to be inviting into my heart and life is just as significant as what I have gone through, you know. And it's like God showed me, you know, this is going to be a broken mess, but I'm going to make something really awesome with it. And if you just keep trusting me and take the next step. And so adoption, another friend of mine who's in the adoption world, she coined the term brutiful, because it's brutal and beautiful. Like, it is an amazing thing. And so I forget where you're going with your question, but.
I just wondered, like, you know, had you kind of crossed this line of like, man,
of healing.
We are healed enough to move forward in this. So
well, I do think that, I think it's unwise for any prospective adoptive parent to not be at least a decent place in their healing journey before they pursue adoption.
Yes.
So I do feel like we had at least processed that enough mm-hmm. time had gone by. We had done counseling. So mm-hmm.
well, otherwise
I feel
like
we were
like,
in a healthy place. Yeah,
yeah. Otherwise it's like, you know, maybe if I can use a romantic relationship example,
yeah.
it's like calling off the wedding 8 hours beforehand
right.
and having a first date 4 days later.
Correct. Yes.
No.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, it's
and
just
it was
not
a
gonna
long
work.
Journey for us. I mean, we, by the time our son came home, we had been married for 13 years at that point.
Well, our last miscarriage was in 06, and we didn't start the adoption process until 08.
Correct.
So 2 years
yeah.
had gone by even since that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so your son is was born in Africa.
Mm-hmm. Born in Ethiopia.
In
yep.
Ethiopia. And So you guys wound up going the international route.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of hop on a plane like you're going on vacation or a mission trip, only you come back and there's one more of you. Like,
right.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Had a
you
second
know?
Trip.
Few steps before that happened. About a 3-year-long process
well,
by the time you got
we
home?
Joined a program that at the time when we started, it was 7 to 9 month wait. I mean, that's what they said. Once you submit all your paperwork and you're ready for referral, which is the information packet on the child, it's 7 to 9 months. And so we're like, whoa. This is going to be so awesome.
Oh, yeah, we're going to be
just
family
like a regular
in no
pregnancy.
Time. Yeah.
You know? But it took 22 months to get our referral for Tate. Like, it was unbelievable. The popularity of the program in the state that we had no idea.
Yeah, there was an explosion of interest in that program because
Ethiopia kind of boomed at the time.
Yeah. And then, I mean, people who have been through international adoptions or any adoption understand this, like that there are times where new programs like that open, and if you're not careful, unscrupulous things start happening.
Right.
And so Ethiopia started coming under scrutiny from the international adoption community, and they had to, you know, get some things figured out. But that impacts the families who are in process, and so it ended up taking a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Not for the faint of heart, for sure.
Exactly.
And so how old was Tate when he showed up in your lives?
We met him for the first time when he was 8 months old.
Yep.
And then again, there's backstory to all of this, but we had to make 2 trips to Ethiopia. So the first trip we met him, and he was 8 months old at that point. And by the time we were able to actually bring him home, he was 13 months old, which is, there's a...
Because our files hit some snags. There was missing stamps because we had been in the process so long, certain things expired that they didn't foresee.
You have to do it again.
You have to do it again. And
then you're back in the bureaucratic system, you know,
right.
All the red tape and all that stuff.
Right.
So walk me through that, like, you know, somebody that's maybe come through your journey, you come home with this kid, he's, you know, a little over a year old, which means he's really active.
Yes. Just about to walk.
How do you go about becoming a family?
Patience. And I worried about absolutely everything. Sometimes I wish I could go back and relive those first few months and just soak it up more because I was scared out of my mind. Like, here you go, here's your kid. And I thought, oh, it's going to be this instantaneous, I'm just going to love him, like, with this deep, unconditional love. And you know what? I did, but it wasn't, like, it wasn't as romantic as I thought it would
People
be.
People romanticize adoption and think that the moment that a child is matched with you or put in your home or a baby's put in your arms or whatever you want to say, there's this magical thing that movies do, you know, that isn't what happens in real life. And the reality is that we were the first white people that our son had seen, and he was scared of us because we looked different, and he had been through unbelievable loss of his own and was grieving even as an infant and trying to figure out how to deal with his own loss. And literally, the first thing that happened when they put him in Angie's arms for the first time is he screamed.
Like, louder than I've ever heard a child scream. And so that was
and
a little
it just
hard
kept
to deal
going
with.
And kept going and kept going because he was terrified.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously, you know, we're in a great place now, and there's a lot of attachment things that, you know, we've been really intentional about.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was
hard. Those first few months
hard.
We just cried together, and I remember him being very stiff as I rocked him, but just little by little, I could almost see him relaxing, and I was relaxing too, and like we were just starting to learn to let our walls down and love each other. And it took a few months. I used to sing to him every night.
Yeah, I was going to say, and Angie has a very distinct recollection of the first time, she calls it when he melted.
Yeah.
Like, the very first time that he wasn't stiff anymore, and he just let her hold him and hug him and rock him.
Amazing.
And it was a defining moment, like, for our family.
And we fell in love. Been in love ever since.
Oh, yeah.
He's the best kid ever.
So, you know, if we can kind of loop back to the book here.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of thought this was just something you were going to do. Like, nobody's going to see this. It's
I just had
kind
a
of
story
a
to
thing.
Get out, and it took me forever to get it out.
So it's an allegory, and then kind of, you know, I don't even want to say maybe almost against your will a little bit. Like, other people liked it, and so you've been out speaking about this and helping other women that have been through this, this process. So, where do you start with that? You know, it's like if you just found out this just happened to somebody, they went through miscarriage or, you know, something, where do you, because we talked about, like, don't be the awkward person after a tragedy, like, just be around. So is that where you start?
Usually I just reach out to people, phone call, text, you know, some of these people. Well, I should mention that two friends and I have just started a ministry called Glory's Baby that is specifically for women who are going through this journey of grief and loss, like miscarriage, stillbirth, infant death. And one of the things we do is meet monthly, have a support group where we just get together and share our stories and see where we're at. We do check-in, you know, like, how are you today? Because I didn't have that. Like, I knew people that had lost children, but I just wasn't in a place emotionally to reach out to those people. So now that I'm on this side of the story, I can be that person who reaches out and says, you know, I know what you're going through, but I don't know your story. So why don't you tell me what that is? And we just have really amazing moments of healing, just validating each other. Yeah, I felt that too. I totally have cried those tears. And, you know, there is no great answer. You know, it's a long process of healing, you know. So we just get each other. We always laugh. This is a club that nobody wants to be a part of.
Yeah.
But once you find the club, you're like, these are my sisters. These are people that get me, and it's really, really amazing to watch God work in those relationships.
Let's close this thing out by talking about churches.
Yeah.
Because I mentioned in the beginning, it's like, man, churches have no idea what to do with. There are some things that are just really tough to address. And I think back to, you know, been in church my whole life. And so, you know, thinking even back to Mother's Day, Father's Day sermons when I'm 12, now that I'm an adult, I'm like, man, you guys really screwed that one up. You know, and like, we're going to the holidays. And so, you know, the holidays amplify everything, you know, family related, everything. So how can churches do a better job of this? Because, you know, I would say that most, you know, if you just throw a rock and hit your average church in America, they probably just don't want to talk about it at all.
That's what I would say. I mean, it's obviously a very complicated, complex thing. But if I were going to say one thing, I would say just talk about it. Like, just acknowledge the fact that it happens, and that grief and loss is real. You know, churches like everything to be encouraging and uplifting and positive and happy, and there are people in our midst who are dealing with very real and significant hurt and grief and loss. And for us, happens that ours came through, you know, miscarriage, but it's certainly not the only thing that people wrestle with and deal with. No. And you've just gotta talk about it and be okay talking about it and living in the tension that comes from it.
Maybe even trying devoting a service to grief, but the hope, you know, that Christ brought to the world. I mean, it's a perfect segue into the birth of Jesus. I mean, like, there was grief. The world was black and void, you know, but then a light dawned. And so, like, we have done that in the past at our church where we've devoted a whole service to the blueness of Christmas and how sometimes that we just need to validate
sometimes,
it.
Yeah, sometimes that third week of Thanksgiving to that third week of December is the toughest thing. I mean, it's the toughest time of year. It's the time with the most depression.
Yeah, it amplifies it because, you know, the world would tell you that you should be happy. And, you know,
right, it's the most wonderful time of year.
It's a wonderful time.
But
not
for everyone, not all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
The book is called A Tale of Mending. I want to, you know, throw that out there one more time because this is something that you can Lulu.com is the place that you can grab it, right? And then I'm sure that there are people who are going to say, I want to know more, you know, if they happen, you know, Shine.fm covers a pretty large area, but if they happen to be in the southwest suburbs, you know, they might want to join you. How can we help those people get plugged in?
They can find me very quickly on the Glory's Baby Facebook page. If you look up Glory's Baby, it's GLORY S baby. That is our ministry webpage, and I am on there all the time and can connect with people via that. I can share my email and information too if you'd like.
Okay, we'll throw that in the show notes of the podcast. Yeah. You know, if you're hearing this on the radio, you can search Stronger Together, Shine.fm podcast on iTunes, and you can get the information right there. And, you know, we will just throw out, you guys both, you know, lead people in worship at Parkview Christian Church, mm-hmm. three campuses. You know, if you listen to Shine.fm and you don't have a church home at all, or you haven't been to church in years, pick one, mm-hmm. go to it for Christmas. And, you know, we can say that this is definitely one of those ones that you could pick. There are three campuses in Orland Park, Homer Glen, and New Lenox, there will be 30 million Christmas services this year.
20, to be exact.
20, yes. 20 million, 20, sorry.
20 Christmas Eve services starting on Thursday, the 21st.
Dan and Angie Leverance, once again, the book is A Tale of Mending. You can find out more information by searching Glory's Baby on Facebook. Mm-hmm. This is Stronger Together.
That was Stronger Together, a show about growing in marriage, parenting, relationships, and community. Subscribe to the Shine.fm podcast to catch every episode of Stronger Together, available on the iTunes podcast app and wherever podcasts are available.